Well, I'm very pleased to welcome back to Fremantle Shipping News, Dr. Brad Petter, the former, or maybe he's not yet the former, Mayor of Fremantle. Welcome, Brad.
Thank you, Michael. Nice to be with you.
So, what happens? And, well, let me go back a step. Congratulations, you're to be sworn in as a member of the Upper House, the Legislative Council of the Parliament of Western Australia.
Yes, not sworn in to May the 21st. So, so this is a slightly unusual space I'm in right now where I've stepped down as mayor, gone on leave without pay, but whilst knowing I won't be sworn in for a little while yet, but actually it's all started in reality. I've got induction next week at Parliament House and it feels like it's all go.
Yeah. Well, it's going to be a very exciting time for you. Everybody knows that after Labor swept the whole of the Parliament just about in the last election, they now control both houses of Parliament, and parties like the Greens had, what, four upper house members?
That's right.
Reduced to one, and it's you, and you're a newbie.
Yes, that wasn't...
Part of the plan.
It wasn't part of the plan. It certainly wasn't how I was imagining it. Being elected is... I'm really happy about that. It feels a little bit like a silver lining in some ways to otherwise a pretty negative election outcome for the Greens. The Greens' vote wasn't terrible. I mean, it dropped about 2 or 3%. But it wasn't catastrophic, but it's just the way that the upper house system works, and the preference flows meant that, to be honest with you, I was lucky. And others were unlucky, and that was a bit of the roll of the dice that is the upper house system.
Well, the election, people have probably forgotten, it was some weeks ago, and you had just announced a couple of days ago as having secured the sixth position in the South Metropolitan region in the upper house. What was it like waiting at a personal level?
It was excruciating, to be really honest with you. And it was kind of psychologically quite really interesting because you're literally just waiting. And I actually had to, and I ended up going down south. I was like, and disengaging, because otherwise you can't help but hit the refresh button on the ABC election app. And and it was just like watching your future change by the day. You know, you're in, you're out, you're just not sure. So, and then it just went, it went quite dark for a while. And then ultimately, it came down to quite a strange process where we had to go in to the electoral, to the final vote itself, where they pushed a button on a computer for the result to come up.
Oh my goodness.
So, and even that process took 45 minutes because of the computer couldn't deal with a whole range of tires that had to be done manually. It was excruciating. But it was kind of an experience that I'm glad to have been part of in some ways. Perhaps given the result, I may look on it very differently if I hadn't have won.
There are some new parties or individuals, perhaps with a party-sounding name, that have found their way into the upper house as a result of the elections. The Daylight Saving Party, a man's coming back from Seattle or somewhere. Legalised Marijuana Party, who are probably quite convinced and want to push their barrow. They are micro parties by any definition. Did micro parties play a part in the tightness of your election?
Absolutely. So the Greens weren't part of any preference deals. So there are a couple of different groups who did kind of preference deals with micro parties and kind of tried to game the system. And look, I think you could say Daylight Savings is a classic example of that. When you get 98 first preference votes and get elected to a region that has historically strongly opposed daylight savings, you can see a system that's pretty broken. And but even in South Metro, and this is actually what felt like a bit of the lottery of the system, it was a bit of a lottery about who went out first and how preferences flowed. Totally beyond your control. It's not about your vote, it's about other people's votes and how quickly they drop out, and then the cascading effect of that.
Mm.
And it literally felt like a lottery.
A lottery. As I understand it, back in the 10, 11 years ago, when the micro parties came to the fore in the Commonwealth arena, there were reports written, academic studies made, and new legislation to control electoral matters, which caused a new voting system come into play to reduce the potential for micro parties to do what they'd been doing. That approach has been followed around Australia, with the exception of WA and Victoria. One assumes, and I think the Premier, amongst others, has already said he'd like to see change. Yeah. Where do the Greens stand on this?
We've supported that change from before this election, and we'll continue to support it. The truth of the matter is that there should be a system where the voter intent, what they want to see happen, is kind of transparent and open, and they can clearly do that. Sticking a box above the line and leaving that to some backroom deals that no one's has any sense of or understanding of is not good democracy. So the choice you've got is, which about 3 or 4% of people do, is you can number in order, 60 or more candidates, which is a big ask, and leads to invalid votes. Get one of those wrong, and your vote's invalid.
So the simple solution would appear to be, following the general approach of other states, to eliminate above the line voting and say, if there are 40 or 60 people below the line, you only have to number the first 6 or 10.
That's right. And that kind of limited or kind of preferential voting, I think, is actually quite transparent. And it's quite, I'm personally comfortable with the idea that if you have no idea who the next 50 are or what they stand for, the idea that you should need to number them, yes, it actually makes no sense, because it's not but you've got a pretty clear sense of who your top 6 or top 10 are, then that would, yes, be actually the voters having quite a clear say.
Yes. Assuming News published a little piece which relied on a Commonwealth government report recently, and it's clear that changing the system actually empowers the voter.
Mm.
They are happy to think,
yep,
and they're forced to think. They go down and they pick the first 6 or 10 people. They are saying who they would prefer to actually have in Parliament. Mm.
And I think it's a really good system, and it's one that the Greens will support. I expect we'll see this government move on this. I think the daylight savings issue, that party has just created such a sense in the voters' minds that this has to change.
Particularly as we all don't like daylight saving, apparently.
Well, I personally like daylight savings. I would happily support daylight savings, although I can't see that item being brought to in front of the parliament in this term.
Yes. Well, there is the fading of the curtains issue.
Well, that's right. Yes. But when we live here in Frio, and long nights are pretty nice by the beach. So
now, Brad, I mean, you end what can be called your initial involvement in politics through local government and being the mayor here, mm, in Fremantle for some years, and you now move into the state political scene. I'm suspecting it's going to be quite, well, momentous. It's going to really be some quite big changes in your life. Mm. You seeing it that way?
Yeah, I am. And look, I'm going to miss the role as mayor. I know that, and I kind of knew that going into this. The mayor role is pretty unique in the sense of you get to be part of a council that makes decisions which are very real and very concrete, and you see those changes in your neighbourhood within months of making those decisions. I mean, it's a one, and you're very connected to a community, and the feedback's really clear, and it's great. You actually get to do some really good things. Being one member in the upper house of a state parliament, your ability to influence and have direct outcomes is going to be greatly reduced. Yeah, so I realise that change, but I also very much, I think one of my frustrations as mayor was realising that so many things that we at Frio needed to do and needed to be part of needed the support of the state government or needed changes at a state and federal level. And I could either keep whinging about that and stay as mayor or actually realise that there's an opportunity to kind of actually try and be part of that change at a state level.
That raises an interesting question. I think many state politicians find themselves in this position. You're both, in a sense, a local member, whether in the upper house or the lower house, interested in local issues in a community you understand well as having this broader state vision. Can you see yourself remaining, not getting in the road of the council or anybody else, but involved in what happens around Fremantle?
That's a really good question. I think this is a really careful balancing act in some ways. You don't want to be nothing worse than ex-mayors kind of randomly kind of injecting themselves into debates half informed. But that said, I will be, you're right, I will be the executive representative for the South Metropolitan Region, of which Fremantle is an important part. I think there is actually understanding your different roles, and that, to take an example with me, so Fremantle has been quite keen on on light rail or trackless trams, kind of transit to the south. So my role in that now will actually be, it's a project that I still remain passionate about, but being a member of parliament, I can take more of a, how do we get that planning happen at a regional level, whilst the council will get on and try and do the stuff more locally, and understanding that separation.
Yes. Mm. And you kindly have always been available in the shipping news, wanted to talk about Fremantle Things. When we launched just over 4 years ago, you came along as mayor and spoke, and you told us a lot about your own personal background on that occasion. And more recently, we've talked about what's been achieved and what happens in Fremantle and around Fremantle. And the point's always been made that if you wanted to do things down at the port, that's the state government.
Yes, that's right.
If you want to see Victoria Quay redeveloped, that's the state government.
Yep.
If you want to do things anywhere near railway lines, that's the state government.
Yep.
There are many reserved areas that belong, in a sense, every sense, to the state government. So there are limitations on what you can do.
Yes.
And after the COVID planning legislation was put through, it's all state government if you want to spend more than $25 million on
that's
development.
Right. And so we have actually seen, and even before that with the DAPs, Development Assessment Panels, the power, as my time as mayor over the last 11 and a half years, has shifted towards the state government.
Yes.
I mean, the truth of the matter is, we advise on those things, but you know, we're largely approving single houses and carports these days, and anything above that is being approved by state government, by panels that have majority of members appointed by the state.
Without this being the final word or a definitive response, and taking your last point about local government, what is the significance of local government, and in particular the city of Fremantle, in the larger scheme of things?
I think Fremantle remains significant. I've always thought of Fremantle as a city, a place of consequence. I think was it George Snedden or someone along those lines. And I think it's just true. It's not just another suburb. It's a place that has played a really important role historically. I think continues to be a progressive community that kind of punches above its weight. And I think actually is a really important place for greater Perth. I mean, it's something that's pretty special, and we don't want to let it just kind of drift towards being another dormitory suburb. So that's why it's been one of my passions as mayor, is actually keeping it as a place of consequence. I think there's going to be some big challenges for that. I mean, I think the government's majority will mean that their commitment to move the port, if they want to do that, they can realise that now, and there's not much anyone can do about it. So I think those kinds of things that have kind of, so Fremantle is going to have to really be focused on how does it get different kinds of jobs, different kinds of industry, to keep it as a place of consequence. That said, I think the announcements, for example, like the $100 million film studios, is really important for Freo's future, because I think instead, if it can become a real hub for creatives, using some of the amazing assets we've got, then that's a good start. Is that a substitute for a working port? I'm not sure, but I certainly want to make sure that Fremantle doesn't kind of make mistakes that almost, I think, the places like Subiaco did or others did, where they just kind of let themselves not have a kind of their clear identity. I think Fremantle needs to maintain that.
Yes. If you were being self-reflective and thinking about the people, if you like, politically or in local government terms, didn't like you or what the council was up to, what have been the main criticisms? Does it come down to this question of making Fremantle commercially viable?
I think that was for a long time a criticism. I don't think that one's holding up particularly well anymore, because the truth of the matter is everybody can see now that we have got lots of new investment of different kinds. It's been much slower than any of us would have liked, but be fair to say, until recently, in fact, you know, the WA economy was in a domestic recession at least. That's kind of happening. Look, I think there are still some challenges for Fremantle, and those are around making it feel like a safe, inviting place, especially for families downtown. I think that's been one of my frustrations is, and our goal was always actually, I think, a good one, which was the more people we got downtown, the safer and more inviting it would be. It kind of builds on itself. But that's been a much harder goal to realise. I think that continues to be. And now we've got this housing crisis that's clearly emerging. next few years are going to be increasingly challenging in that place, if, especially if we see homelessness increase on the back of that. So there are those kinds of things that I wish we'd somehow managed to get more traction on. And again, but these are state government issues. This is actually part of the issue. What actually came out in the state around Tent City was housing and homelessness. This local government can't solve this by ourselves. The people we see are homeless, come between Perth and Fremantle in a pretty fluid kind of way. They're not isolated from each other.
I've been impressed with the social housing debate because it's beginning to get quite sophisticated at a broader community level. We're all familiar with people who look entirely indigent. They're on the street. They've got their shopping trolley with a bundle rolled up in it, and you'll find them here and there. But of course, social housing issues go way beyond that.
Yeah.
And we know about older women who are single who've lost a place to call home. And they're being focused on in different ways.
Yep.
There are families who, through perhaps very often domestic violence, typically women and the children who are looking for places, there's a lot of needs. And the community seem to be, right across the political spectrum, attuned to that.
Yes.
Achieving outcomes is hard.
Achieving outcomes is hard in some ways, but it's actually not, I don't think it's that hard.
It's not impossible.
No, not at all. And I think this is actually about where a really important role for the state around stepping up and it's a whole, and what you're right, because it's not about just the pointy end, which we see, which is the visible street person homelessness. That's part of it, making sure we've got crisis accommodation. But it's actually the many different kinds of housing you need along that spectrum, all the way from, a good social housing stock that's appropriate for different people at different stages of their lives, all the way through to affordable rentals and affordable houses that people can own. And when you get that spectrum right, it takes the pressures off other parts of it. And for me, this is actually, I think, where Fremantle has shown extremely good leadership in the space, all the way through from when Phil St. John came up with the idea of that granny flats without grannies, the small dwellings, and that now is statewide policy. But that started in Fremantle. The freer alternative around big ideas for small housing is playing itself through as a trial at the moment. Again, these are the kind of things that need to be mainstreamed across the state if we're going to have both the range of housing that we need. And I mean, you mentioned the housing for older women, that's the My House project that's happening in North Fremantle at the moment. That we just need more of these kinds of things. And they're not, we've proven they can happen. It's about scaling it up now.
Yes. Now, in that sense, you start to leave Fremantle as a distinct geographical identity behind, and many of the issues we just touched upon, of course, have a statewide aspect to them. But when you arrive in the Parliament as a Green, what will the Greens be wanting you to be the spokesperson on? What are going to be the big issues over the life of this Parliament that you'll be seen on television every other night speaking to?
It's a really good question, one I don't have a solid answer on yet, because I wasn't expecting to be the only Green in the Parliament. In fact, when I got elected, Alison Zabon, who was the leader of the WA Greens, she was very strong on the social issues and kind of...
She got you into this game.
She did, indeed. And the mental health, she's impressive on that stuff. And so we actually had a bit of a sense of hoping we'll both be there and could actually kind of our different roles would come together quite well. We don't have that now. And the truth of the matter is, we have to make some hard choices around what we do, because we can't do everything. We're one person, I get two staff, that's it. And so there's only so much that you can do, but there's no doubt for me that is housing and homelessness will be a big issue. Climate is, I think, again, this government, there's some great stuff we can do in making this state more responsive in the climate space and renewable energy space, which is some smart low-hanging fruit that I hope we can get on the table. And I do think then there are probably some of those integrity and government issues as well around, actually, I think we need to get smarter on donations, on transparency in terms of government. They'd be my top three, and I'll probably also then put mental health as another one where I don't consider myself an expert. I have some lived experience of that in my family, but I think there's clearly some changes that need to happen in that space as well.
In a practical sense, you mentioned you'll have two staff. And that's through the parliamentary vote, if you like, for you. Will you finish up hiring people who are able to be your researchers and your writers and the people who assist you in those areas, or how does that work?
Yeah, so that's actually one of the key issues I need to get my head around now, is what the best kind of staff I need. Do you want policy staff, or do you want staff who can do media and social media? Do you want staff who can do admin? I mean, so there is a mix of those. And I think for me to be effective, it's going to require some good collaborations. And I'm actually thinking, I've got good links with universities. I'm actually hoping that actually some of that policy stuff I can actually do in collaboration with my colleagues in the universities, whilst having some of that skill on board. Acknowledging as well that a big part of my role will be make sure we get those ideas out there. So you don't want to just be a policy wonk working in the background. As the only green in Parliament, we need to make sure we're communicating what we're doing as well.
Yes. I imagine trying to get the proverbial home-life balance right will create pressures
yes.
in the time ahead, more so than in the past. You're able to ride your bike from home to the council offices. It's a little bit further into the hill in...
That's true. Yeah. Although, I mean, obviously, the Parliament doesn't sit every week, so I'm still hoping I'll be able to get an office that's still within bike riding distance of home.
Is
the plan. And I've got a very patient partner, and who, despite having a 3.5-year-old, we seem to manage it pretty well. And look, the mayor job was busy. This one won't be any less busy. That's reality.
Yes. Moving, not the perfect segue, but from being the sole Greens member in the Parliament to the Greens themselves, what is the future of the Greens? You mentioned that there's been a drop in their vote, not too significant, but nonetheless. How will that be analysed? Do you think it's all to be put down to COVID? To the popularity of the Premier? Someone wrote a Country and Western song about him, which was rather superb. I mean, I'm assuming, as an outsider looking at all of these things, that the major parties traditionally, like the Liberal Party and the Nationals in Western Australia, will rebound at the next election, and so will the Greens. But is the world change?
Well, that's my... Look, I think it's my assumption too. I think the extent to which we rebound, and that's actually one of the reasons I'm pleased I'm here, I think it would have been harder to rebound having no one in Parliament. So I think that's some of that responsibility is going to come down to me and the team that surrounds me. But the extent to which we rebound, I think, is going to be about how relevant we make ourselves in the next few years. I consider myself to be a pragmatic progressive. And by that I mean I think... It's about actually what are the solutions that we can all agree on, and I think there's some really low hanging fruit that we can kind of take to the Parliament to say these are win-wins, regardless of your ideological views. These are wins from, and so I guess that's what I'm hoping to work really hard on, is actually showing how the Greens are actually a party of solutions, and solutions that work in that triple bottom line sense, so around economy, society, and environment, not just one of those.
You've mentioned low-hanging fruit, and I can't let them dangle much longer from the tree or the vine. What are some of the fruits you think waiting to be picked, you and the existing government?
Yeah, so we've talked about housing already, and I think there are some really simple stuff we can do around how we change our planning system. These are low-cost things to get a greater diversity of housing that actually matches up with the high housing we need. So, I mean, the stat I often roll off is Western Australia is currently building the largest houses in the world. And with some of the least people in them. I mean, and we wonder why we have a housing crisis. We have three times the floor area per person than we did 50 years ago. So I think it's actually around smaller, more diverse houses for different stages of people's lives, more smart infill. So for me, those kinds of things are exciting. And I think Freo, again, is showing how you can do that. And I look forward to seeing how we can start to roll some of those things out. And then the renewable energy space is the other one, which I'm very excited about. WA is in such a good position in terms of we've got wind, we've got sun, we've got land. We can do this. But also, there are some things that don't even require infrastructure investment. How we change our tariffs. I mean, at the moment, we are producing more renewable energy than we can use during on a sunny day. And asking people to turn their solar systems off. That's just crazy. Why don't we actually change our tariffs to get people to use more power, charge up their electric vehicles, run their washing machines during the day? There is some smart low-hanging fruit in this space that I think it just requires the right kinds of leadership, and we can get the kind of changes that we need.
And in terms of the broader climate debate, is there a particular set of propositions that the Greens would like the government to adopt?
So certainly I think there are, I think we need a clear target around renewable energy. We are one of the only states now without a renewable energy target. Renewable energy is increasing in the state. We're actually doing quite well, but it's solely on the back of individual households putting solar on their roofs. I mean, this is not a planned approach. It's almost like a weird government hands off, we're just going to let this happen. But this is not the way to manage an energy system. So actually need a proper plan around how we do this, which is about rooftop solar, wind, and storage. So batteries or pumped hydro. Again, these are not complex solutions, but around what's our steps? And also we need having a, how this state gets to net zero in emissions. A 2050 target is good, but what are your interim targets? There's no point just having one target 30 years out and no steps to get there. So I'm actually saying, what are we gonna do in the meantime? Having a clear plan. I'm very excited that one of the first things this government has done is have a new Minister for Climate Action. That role didn't exist before. That encourages me that we are going to see some action in space, and we'll be very supportive of that.
Well, Brad, it's been really nice talking to you today. You've moved into a new world. Late May. Have to get yourself organised between now and then. We'll be very pleased if we're able to talk to you a bit later in the year as to how this is all working out.
I'd love to, yeah.
But once again, congratulations and all the best wishes in the new job.
Thanks, Michael. Thanks for the opportunity.